You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. My guest today is Claudette Fetti. We talk about something that honestly is a little bit intense, so that's your warning. But I think you're ready for it. I really do. Claudette shares with us the experience she had of parenting a child with mental health issues and struggles. She shares with us what happened, what went on, what were the challenges in things like getting a diagnosis and treatment options, the choices that she and her family made along the way, and some of the impact of those choices that happened. So this is a lot of story in a short amount of time. Mental health and mental illness are, I feel, definitely more openly discussed today than they were, at least in my childhood. But I think that this is something that is still a very helpful conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. And so if you're ready, let's get to it. Claudette Fetti, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm so happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am.
Yay. All right, let's do it. All right, I start all my conversations with the same first question. What part of the world are you in?
I am in Rawston, Texas, which is way north Texas, almost into Oklahoma.
All right, very nice. And then my next warm-up question is, this episode is going to come out. We're not recording it in the winter holiday season, but it's going to come out in the winter holiday season. What is a part of that season of the year that you do not enjoy?
That's a hard one because I think it's one of my favorite seasons. How difficult it is to coordinate things to see grandkids around everybody else's schedule because I'm not the only one who wants them.
I can completely imagine that, the busyness and the complexity of a big family, 100%. All right. So the topic of the day that we're going to talk about today is raising a child with a mental health illness. And I actually am thrilled, which is an interesting choice of words for this, thrilled to have this conversation because I think it's important. I think that in 2025, even though it feels like there's more visibility and awareness about mental health, this is still a spot of the human experience where a lot of people go through a portion of it, but there's a lot of isolation, pressure, difficulty, all of those things. I'm no way qualified in the industry to make that statement. That's just my human experience. To kick off this conversation, share with us who we're talking about. What's the relationship that you had with the person that we're talking about today?
So my son.
Okay.
And he was born. I was a teenager when he was born, and in all kinds of adverse circumstances. And so he had a lot of adverse experiences early. And what happens with parents, we all, when we're pregnant, think we're raising the next president of the United States. That's just the way it is. And he was brilliant and he was beautiful and he was all of those things. None of us, most of us, I won't say none, there's probably someone out there who was eminently qualified. Most of us don't come to that qualified or understanding mental illness or mental health needs.
Sure.
We come with the skills that we were given by our parents.
Yeah.
And those may have been adequate or inadequate or whatever. My parents were okay. They were not highly skilled, and I was not highly skilled. Aaron, however, really needed a highly skilled parent. And that's not what he got. So we kind of fumbled through, and it was a long time before I really realized what I needed to do. I came to it like most people do, with the idea that it is an illness. They're going to label it, and that label means that we're going to fix it. We're going to find the right pill, the right whatever, the right therapy, and we're going to not have to deal with it anymore. And so that was our push. Unfortunately, what that does for kids is they're in the position of being broken. So they are the broken one that you are trying to fix and shopping them around to every person who claims to have some fix for it. And we did some pretty wild attempts at fixes. The reality was, though, he was hallucinating by the time he was 5. And most of the therapies that we went to were behavioral, which assumed that the fix is in the environment, and there are fixes in the environment that are supportive, but that if we did the right combination of consequences and rewards, that we would shape him out of it. That doesn't work that way.
So let's pause for a second and go through that, because you put a lot, you already went through a lot of stuff that I want to make sure we touch on, because there was a lot that went in there. And one of my clues of your level of experience is that you use some vocabulary that we only get with a lot of experience. You use the word adverse circumstances, right? Which probably we don't learn those words until somebody teaches us. There's actually, I'm going to make a guess that that comes from, there's a quiz out there, which is the ACE quiz, which is it's a very short quiz, which is the adverse circumstances, adverse childhood events, which they use to sort of sometimes kick off some of these evaluations. So you were a young parent when you had your son, and you mentioned something that we'll come back to in a second. Are you comfortable sharing? Because you said that he was 5 years old when he began to hallucinate. Are you comfortable sharing what is the illness or the diagnosis that you eventually got that we're talking about today?
So probably the most accurate, in addition to really significant trauma, which is part of his story, is a schizoaffective disorder. So he had both a thought disorder and a mood disorder, and he was a rapid cycler from the time he was little. So he could be fine in the morning, at the last part of his schooling. They would only let me bring him an hour late, pick him up for lunch, and pick him up an hour early. And that was the conditions under which they would take him. And I could drop him off in the morning, and he would be articulate, my beautiful, wonderful son. And by lunchtime, when I picked him up, he would be in another world, completely delusional and responding to what was going on in that universe and not having any awareness of our reality, of our shared reality.
That sounds like a very complicated and challenging situation to navigate as a caregiver, I gotta be honest. So you mentioned that you came to your parenting experiences. I do believe this is a true thing for most people. You know, there are, even if you study childhood development or education, or you go to medical school to become a psychiatrist, the primary skills that we bring to raising our children are the ones that we got from being children and living with our own parents. And what I find really interesting as my lived experience, and I always lay this out as a joke, is having parents is not great practice for being a parent, in my
No, it is
experience.
not.
And it seems like it should be, right? Like, I had parents, I spent all this time with them. You'd think it would make me more qualified to then turn around and be a parent. But in my own experience, it wasn't great preparation or perfect preparation. It was completely different to be in that role. And so what, you didn't come into your parenting experience ready to parent a child who had mental health difficulties. But what was your, let's talk about what your experience was growing up. What was your relationship with your family like? What were some of those things that you brought into your life as an adult?
So my mother was a person who was essentially abandoned as a kid. And so she really didn't have a lot of skills. She read a lot of those books and she learned skills that she really didn't have. So parenting was challenging for her. And I reminded her from like birth, I think from the moment I could say no, of the woman who abandoned her. I was an artist. I was all of the things that she was, or that was projected onto me, and I owned it. However that happened, I don't know, from early childhood. I was really close to my dad, but he was an army officer, and this was in the 50s and 60s, where mom was in charge of the kids and dad went off and earned money and came home. And dad did a couple of tours in Vietnam, and so there were long stretches. And she, not to say, my mother did the very best that she could. And she was her efforts were marvelous. However, she wasn't highly skilled.
And but you did not know that when you were growing up with that experience. And so this was in the what decade was it when you were an adolescent?
70s.
70s. Okay. So this is th there was the beginning of some mental health stuff, but it was still early days.
There was but not a whole lot around childhood. So, for example, you talked about the ACEs study. That actually came out in the late 90s.
Late 90s, yeah.
It was after Aaron had already gone through trauma, and after we were dealing with it, that it was just emergent. So now that's ubiquitous. We know it everywhere. However, it was not.
Yeah, in fact, for better or worse, it's become so ubiquitous that some people think that the word trauma is now sort of overused. Probably, I don't know if it could be, but you hear that
So
sometimes.
one of the things that we thought when that study came out, prior to that study, and I know that you don't have time for the whole long professor lecture on it, but was that trauma was uncommon. And what we found out from that is, in fact, that's not true. That trauma is very common. And the big thing there is to recognize trauma symptoms and respond to them as trauma, and help people cope with that and come up with strategies that help them be resilient, rather than saying and then looking at them as behavioral and punishing them, which we still do a lot.
It
I
is,
work
yeah.
with kids in the school system, and it is not at all uncommon for them to end up in the juvenile detention kind of corrections. They call it the school to prison pipeline. Because we look at all of that as behavioral and start treating it as behavioral. And that's a whole fork in the road that goes a different direction. But
Yeah,
if you look at it
it's
as a
really interesting because, and this is not the focus of our conversation today, but you mentioned that you did not have the skills and you were a teen mom. And one of the things that in the last year that I've become aware of, maybe 2 years, that I think is really just highlights what you're saying, that we still do this. This is something that happens to families, even when there's tremendous knowledge and resource. The very well-known book, My Beautiful Boy. That family was super highly educated, had a lot of advantages. The story was highly publicized with a lot of attention. They did a 10-year, they republished it after 10 years. They made it into a Hollywood movie. They did a 10-year re-update that came out, I think, last year or the year before. And a friend of mine called me and they're like, you have to read this now. And after 20 years of going through this and all of these things with all of the advantages, it was at that point where somebody finally said, have you ever been screened for a behavioral disorder? I mean, not a thought disorder. And he got a diagnosis. He'd been through the criminal system, through the substance use system. They'd seen every specialist that had a name, spent multiple six figures. And it was up until that point where somebody accurately gave them a diagnosis. And so this sort of misapplication of things without placing blame, and I'm not qualified to assess where the problem is, it's really a challenge, though, I think, for the people who are going through it. And the other recent thing, I watched the Charlie Sheen documentary on Netflix. And, this is just a train wreck of a Hollywood celebrity story. And I'm watching it, and the whole thing is substance use, substance use, substance use. And he was in the thick of it. And even with that, with all of those things, residential stays, more money than you can even imagine to throw at the problem, it was a significant amount of time before he was given a diagnosis of the mental illness that may have been really underlying some of this, like really destructive patterns of behavior. And, Like, so
There's
it's, yeah.
a misnomer that giving that label is going to fix it too.
Yeah.
We know, unlike when Aaron was growing up, a lot of the best practices today were emergent then. So it would have been unusual for me to have gotten access to them. They're not emergent anymore. I still participate in local staffing for kids at risk of residential treatment because they've exhausted everything in my county. And I still find the same kind of lack of, because even though we know what to do, putting the resources toward it, and I live in Texas, which is horribly underfunded in terms of mental health, putting the resources toward doing what we know to do with any fidelity is just, it
Yeah.
doesn't occur. So I have families that were looking at it going, okay, they have done everything. And a move is what we're looking at now is kind of, okay, so what state is doing a better job of this? And it's not because people in our systems are horrible people. They are fabulous people who are so under-resourced
Yes.
that they don't have what they need to do what we know with any fidelity to the model. And it's not the same practice if you're
Right.
just kind of
And
hitting.
so what you're talking about is families who might have the resources or the desperation and commitment that when they end up in this situation where they need a specialized, they want and think that a specialized set of resources will really help. They're physically uprooting and going to a different location where they can get those resources. And to people who are listening who might think that's crazy, the first time that I actually heard about somebody doing that was decades ago when I met somebody who moved to the town where I lived because they had an autistic child. And they moved to a place where there was a specialized team that was doing innovative work. But since then, that was decades ago, just as people I know, I've known people who have, I knew somebody who uprooted and moved to Houston for cancer care, which is one of those things. And I've met people who have relocated to other states where there's specialized care. So it is something that extends, but it is, when you talk about resources and systems, it's definitely one of those things where most people are not going to know that's even a possibility or have the means to be able to make it happen. And so that's definitely
And
okay.
then
So,
right now, looking at all of the challenges with grants and resources, it's also checking out and making sure that's still there. You
oh,
know,
fair enough. Yeah.
is it still resourced there? Just because it was
It's a,
before
it's, yeah,
current
no.
chaos, no telling. It
No
may not
telling.
be right now.
So take us back to the beginning of this, because one of the things you said that I think is really interesting that I'm not sure I've ever heard before, but I'm not an expert. You noticed that he, take us back to the beginning. What were the challenges that you were going through? And was it hard getting doctors, finding diagnoses, all of that kind of thing? You mentioned that he was having hallucinations at five,
We
which,
didn't know that at five.
okay. So
We didn't know that
what were the
till later.
challenges that showed up at the beginning?
Behavioral. He was kicked out of daycares from early, early, early. They looked like behavioral challenges. Somehow or another, he knew that it was not okay to be seeing clowns playing on the end of his bed. This was way before the huge trauma that he experienced at Strait. And so, early on, kids that I've worked with, in addition to Aaron with psychosis, who have not had significant trauma, hallucinations are kind of fun. They're animals, they're clowns. His was clowns. He would wake up with clowns playing at the end of his bed, kind of in that started in that stage between wake and sleep,
Okay.
which is pretty common. He had autism would have been a fabulous diagnosis for him as a kid, just because it would have provided a different lens than what he got. What he got was that behavioral lens that says, okay, if we just consequence this, and we lived in behavioral mod hell because those were the first people that we found. And that may work if the problem in fact is behavioral.
So is this like tantrums or not following rules, explosions?
All of the above.
Okay.
And in school, and it wasn't as much at home initially. It was more in school. He also had, and it's hard to say, he had a lot of skills at about five. And if so, what we know about thought disorders is when they begin, the first symptoms you see are declines in cognition and ADLs and those and activities of daily living, and take hygiene, all of that, taking care of oneself. And there are impacts upon cognition that happen there. And some of the early psychosis research and practice is around preventing psychosis by managing stress levels. Well, he was a kid. He had a lot of skills going into school. When he went into school, he had lost many of those, whether it was the stress of being in school with a really significant learning disability. He could not write. He was a precocious reader. His language development was incredible. Couldn't put it on paper, couldn't do math. And so early on, it was, I think, probably started, and I'm going back and looking at this not
Right, with the
as it's
knowledge of
emerged
today, right.
because we didn't. But probably a lot of it was avoiding being seen as a kid who was not able to do was what was expected. So it's always better to be bad than stupid, you know.
Okay,
So
good.
I'm gonna they come to me with the math assignment, and I'm gonna knock the crap out of the kid next to me because that gets me to the office and away from math.
Oh, interesting. So in the beginning, when he was young in elementary school, what you thought you were dealing with was a kid who was struggling behaving and performing acceptably in school. At what point?
We did not know about the learning disabilities until much later. And I think some of that was my, again, own ignorance. And I, again, schools are often under-resourced. So having people who recognized, he wasn't recognized for those learning disabilities until he was 10, 11.
Okay. And I
So,
think that some
yes.
of this is like we put like if you turn on the TV and you watch a show about kids in school, or any fictional show, it's like, it gives you this impression that the people who work in the institutions are all world-class experts who have all the time in the world to dedicate to every single person. And in 30 minutes, they meet a kid, they identify an obscure symptom, and they solve it. And I think that that puts people, modern parents and adults, in a tough situation when they're in real-world
And
places like this.
teachers,
And
to be
teachers too,
honest,
right? Teachers too.
teachers have the hardest job in the world with very little resource.
Very little resources. It's
I've worked
not
in
reasonable to
institutions,
expect,
surround them with those experts, and then because they are doing their dead level best.
Yeah, everybody is. And it's just that, it's not reasonable to expect that a parent would be an expert in the situation as a parent. It's not reasonable to expect that a kindergarten teacher is going to identify something they've never seen before. It's not reasonable to expect that an administration has the tool. None of this. There's like the tragic reality of living through it is that that there's not a magic solution at any one of these places that I'm aware of. And that's why I just want to throw it as somebody just who has lived, a human experience. Part of it is not, if you're in a spot right now where you've got a kid who's going through something, be very careful not to turn this lens on yourself and
Oh,
judge
yeah.
yourself for not being able to figure it out. And the same thing goes, you got to be careful not to be too harsh on the people who are in the other roles that they didn't catch it either, because it doesn't always work that way. So, it just doesn't. The music teacher may not have any idea what
Yeah.
ADHD looks like. They just might not know. And it's, that's if they do, you're
And they don't
lucky.
necessarily have strategies.
And they don't have strategies, right?
And
Yeah.
we can, there are strategies. There are really good programs in schools, multi-tiered systems of support. There's all kinds of fabulous things we can do in schools, and we can use a broad multidisciplinary team with lots of different lenses
Yeah.
that enable us to catch things. Resource. It takes.
Resource and be grateful if you've got it. Right? Be grateful if you got it and try not to be too hard on yourself if you missed a signal or if you do that. Not, because I think it's very hard as an adult to, because many people I know with a variety of things, whether or not you find out that your kid has a learning disability, a mental health disorder, even something as straightforward as diabetes, a health disorder, there's a learning curve for the family to learn to manage it. And there's a spot where you can go through and just really be your own worst enemy and think, how did I miss this? And so that's why
Yeah,
I thought about
well,
that.
and that's not all that helpful. It takes,
Right, that's why I brought it up.
yeah, it takes resource away from. I have lots of regret. Guilt is not as useful. So
There you go.
if it does something, if it helps motivate me to get Erin's story out there and talk about things in public that I wouldn't otherwise wanted to have talked about, then it is useful. If it doesn't motivate something that helps, can you really afford it?
Yeah, it's just
There's
it's hard
enough
on
to do.
yourself. Yeah. So at what point was it that you began to get diagnoses or suggestions that this was a mental health condition? And I think there's a point here where you guys go into residential care. So when did that happen?
That happened when he was 12. So he started with the most benign diagnosis, and this happens frequently. Not that ADHD is not real, it is. But there are a lot of disorders that also impair your attention. And people don't like putting heavy labels like thought disorders, like schizophrenia, certainly, schizoaffective disorder on children. And so they generally start with ADHD. And what happened with Aaron first is they started with ADHD and they medicated ADHD. Ritalin is, or stimulants are a great thing if in fact that's what you have. If in fact it's a thought disorder, it's kind of like pouring gasoline on a flame. So things got much worse. And then we would put another layer of other medicines on top of it to manage that. And it was just this constant, and by the time he was 12 years old, the school had already previously that year asked me to take him home and just not tell anybody, that I would just do what you can. And we had a great year. Several things happened, and he ended up back in the school system. He had one of those days where I had, this was the point at which they said, okay, we'll take him back. If you bring him an hour late, pick him up from lunch and for lunch, and then pick him up an hour early. So he was there only for as little as possible. And I had dropped him off in the morning and he was great. I picked him up at lunch and he was in some other reality where they were coming to kill him and it was better for him to kill himself than whoever it was to kill him, and I could not reach him in that reality. So I wrapped my arms around him. I said, you're safe. I'm here. Nothing is going to hurt you. And he had no idea that I was there. So we had been court ordered to put him in school. So I had called the court and I said, I can't bring him back like this. This is a disaster waiting to happen. And they said, okay, then you have to bring him to the public mental health system, which we had not been involved with. I had done private pay stuff, everything I could think of, everything I could do all along. So we went to the first appointment they had in the afternoon, and I called his counselor, who was booked all day, saw him end of day. But we went to MHMR first. By that time, he had cycled back out, had no memory of all of that. He was again my beautiful, charming boy, and I was a wreck. So I bring him in. They don't know either one of us. They bring him back. They talk to him, and they came back out and said, patted me on the hand and said, "You're okay. He's okay. He's
Go
okay.
home. Yeah,
It's
go home.
fine. It's fine." So by the time I got to his regular counselor, who knew us, end of evening, I had had the thought that if I could make this up, maybe it's me. Maybe I have completely lost my mind. So we walked into the counselor's office and I said, one of us is really sick and I just need you to figure out who and let's do it, you know, whatever. And he said, you know, that Aaron was really sick. And so we got him into an acute psychiatric hospital that was not the abusive facility, but back in the 80s, we did a lot of putting kids in hospitals, and they were incredibly expensive. We exhausted almost all of his lifetime max for mental health coverage in a 3-week stay.
Wow. And this
And
is
they
private
told us,
insurance.
yep.
Okay.
And we didn't have public anything. I didn't even know that we could have qualified, could have, but had no idea. And so they told us that he needed, at the end of that 3 weeks, he needed long-term residential care. And they gave us a place that cost about six, seven times what my husband and I made in a year. And they would not take him. Or I could relinquish him to the state,
Oh my
which
gosh.
families do at that time. And I haven't looked at the numbers lately. It was about 250 of us a year relinquishing kids.
250 in Texas or 250?
Texas,
Okay.
Texas. And so I didn't want to do that. Well, I had in the meantime, over the years, stalked a number of psychiatrists and therapists and people who had, it was before the internet, so it was hard to find information, but when I found it, I just latched onto them. So one of the docs that I had kind of stopped, to be honest, I called and I said, what do we do? What do we do? And he said, well, there's this place up in North Texas that if you, because we didn't live in North Texas, we lived in Central Texas, that if you move up there and take in other kids, he can go to treatment in the daytime and come home at night. And it's more affordable. So we sold everything we owned. We put him into Strait, which was a horribly abusive treatment facility. The reason it was less expensive is they had zero professional staff. It was, and these still exist. Strait was closed down. They're like whack-a-mole because there's a big profit to be made if you have no expenses. So they took him in. They had no idea what they were dealing with. So here he is with psychosis. They're trying really abusive, really behavioral kind of techniques with him. And as those didn't work, they just tried harder. And that didn't work. And it escalated into some pretty horrific abuse,
And
which
so
he
let's break
talks
this
about.
down because I want to make sure people understand what we talk about when we talk about behavioral. I'm going to oversimplify it and you can correct me and go from that. Behavioral consequences are what we talk about when we're doing rewards and consequences for actions.
Yes.
So this is if you smack your sister, you get a timeout for 3 minutes,
And that
or
would be the appropriate use of. And I think that's the theory that they worked from, if there was a theory. Honestly, they didn't really hire staff. They used staff who had gone through this abusive program and hired them.
right.
Those became the staff members and the kids. It was a confrontive encounter group kind of model. And they didn't really know, they didn't understand behavioral stuff. They certainly didn't understand psychosis and what was going on. So the idea was if you just keep, you know, if you just got to do it better, harder, and he will give in. He will
Right.
eventually give in.
And in
Not.
extreme situations, it ends up with kids who are, take the door off their room because they're not getting good grades, restricting food, if they're not
Oh.
following the rules in the cafeteria, things like that. And that's what I've heard about. Those are the places
And
where that
there it
system can
went
go off the rails.
farther than that. There it
Okay.
went farther. He never got to come home. He had to make level two to get home. But there it went farther than that, and involved, like, they kept him up for days on end, spraying water at him
Oh my goodness.
to make him to comply. He ended up with a broken bone. All kinds of different things that happened. And he talks about that. That's his part of the story. But it was extremely abusive. And unfortunately, in our desperate state, we had expended everything we had. We had no more resource. He was suicidal, intermittently, granted, but occasionally when he would get into those states, he was suicidal, and I didn't think I could keep him safe. And so I needed him to be safe. He was not safe. And he left there after a year with both trauma and severe mental illness. And trauma does not make that better. It's a whole nother layer of complexity, but it does not go away. And that's how he hit the road, was we were no longer trustworthy. He tried for a summer there. We all tried really hard, but he never really could trust. He did eventually, but at that point, could not really trust us because we left him there. And he
And
saw
how
us
old? So he
close
was
up.
13 at this point?
He was 12 when it started,
12 when it
13.
started. And you say he hit the road. So that sounds like he left.
He was on the road full time by the time he was 15.
15. So we would say he ran away, living on the streets.
Living on the streets initially, early on, like in that 14, 15 year kind of range, he was in local. He was in Dallas or places around here. But he learned somewhere in there, because he still had paranoia. He still had all of the thought disorder symptoms. And somewhere in there, he figured out how to hop trains. And he would get on a train. He would become really paranoid about wherever he was. He would get on a train and he would go to whatever city it stopped at, and it would start over. And he would stay there for a while. He would
And this is
become
in the
much
1980s.
more. No,
That's
90s. It was the
in the
90s.
nineties. But that's
90s.
when you talk about hopping trains, I think of that as like a 1930s and 40s things.
There's actually a whole population of them.
I did not
They are
realize that.
not really well captured in any data because they don't exist anywhere. They get some bus ticket therapy every now and then. Somebody, they'll land somewhere and they'll go, "Here, I'll give you a ticket. Go somewhere else, you know, and just go." But there's a whole population of them, many of them survivors of places like Strait, but not all. Not all. Lots of different stories there. But they are a population that kind of hides in the shadows.
Oh, that's tragic. Okay, so I have a question, which is, I'm not sure it's a good question, but actually, so like, did you feel like as you were going through this? Because right now we're talking about this, you've got a lot of experience with this, and you're talking about it through the lens of completing it and the full education that you receive going on. And you go on to get, actual academic training and education in these things. But in the
I
moment when
kept
you were going
recycling.
through it, did you feel like you had choices? And the reason that I asked this is I was thinking about it, like if the kids come and they're like, "Hey, I want to take banjo lessons," and I'm like, "I don't even know what that means." But that to me feels like a thing where as an adult I had choices. But when my kids and my stepkids are sick or somebody in my life is sick, that doesn't always feel like a choice to me. That feels like it's happening to me and kind of like I'm swimming upstream. And so the question I thought for you was, when you were in the middle of this, were you able to see the choices as they were coming up, or is that something that you really only can see or you can better see when you look back?
To be honest, some of the choices that would have helped us didn't exist. We didn't understand trauma. That was late 90s. Wraparound and strength, authentic strength-based practice was emergent, but not generally available. So yes, we had choices, but they were bad choices. They were put him in a be at risk again in a behavioral kind of place. Or unfortunately, we were desperate at that point. At the point where he was initially on the streets, he got kind of sucked into some of the neo-Nazi kind of stuff, and I was terrified that he was going to hurt somebody because people like him are good candidates for them. They can manipulate that paranoia. And he eventually got out of that. But during that period of time, I was terrified that he was going to be killed or kill somebody. And so I was pushing him into juvenile justice. Can you call that a choice? I pressed charges on him that had me pay for all the his court costs and for all of the harm done costs. I mean, all on both sides. That seemed like a choice, not a very good one, but it was the only one we had. There wasn't another. It was kind of like going to street. My choice was relinquishment. There was a third choice, but I didn't know it, so I can't say that it was an actual choice because it
Yeah.
felt like letting him die is what
Okay.
it felt like. So he was what we should have, would have, could have done, and what I have learned is just doing something isn't always better than doing nothing. If the something is harmful, you're better off. So it would have been better. He was loved at home. He was, now it would have been good if we understood better strength-based practice and wraparound and some of the, which is another reason for the book, to try to get those ideas out there better. There are good things to do. If we had the alternative that I would go for today would be to keep him home and to have just figured out how to using a strategy like wraparound to build a community around us and address what we needed and really grow his strengths.
Okay. So then I've got two more questions, right? So based on, 'cause you, and I'll, you're leading into there. You lived through this and you made the decisions that you made, and you guys did the absolute best that you could with, which everybody always does. That's just my opinion. I go through the world. I'm like, sometimes, we don't understand why we do things, why
It is
other
that
people do things.
imperfection
Yeah.
in
But I just always
imperfect.
assume that people are doing, the best they think they can with what's happening at the moment, even if it does not look like that at all from the outside. But if you were a magical, omnipotent person, right, what are some of the systems and tools and, this is magical thinking, this is fantasy land here, that with the knowledge of your experience and the academic training and the work experience you've done now, what are some of the things that would have been helpful to you, to your son, to your family in the beginning that would have made this a better experience?
So, the earlier you start, the more effective it is. So, to have started with restorative justice kind of models where we teach kids how to do conflict
Okay.
effectively, and strength-based models where you look at what's this kid good at and enable them to feel competent. We all want to feel competent. And that kind of starts the twist for a lot of kids. I'm going to argue learning disabilities and mental health needs kind of go hand in hand. It sucks to fail as a kid, and failure over and over again is harmful. So making sure that kids from early have the opportunity to succeed, that we not only recognize their strengths, but we know how to facilitate broadening and building on those so that that becomes an identity. That becomes an identity. Those are two big ones. Again, moving forward, restorative justice, as we move forward and kind of learning how to deal with conflict effectively. And looking at people, so there is a whole spectrum of what the human experience is. I love your title of your show, The Art of Imperfect Adulting, but it's imperfect life. You know, we are all, and it doesn't mean we're broken. There is this range of human experience, and we all need to be included. We all need to be have a place where we feel, and not only just feel it, but have the opportunity to contribute, to be needed, to be, if we don't show up, somebody's saying, well, where is she? I'm depending on them. That would be my number one, is strengths and models that support that, multi-tiered systems of support in schools. Well done. Restorative just circles is what they're called in school.
That's one of the random trainings I have is
Yeah,
running restorative justice
love that.
circles. So
I love that. Wraparound, and that wraparound model has principles that I think should guide us through across disciplines for children. And looking at childhood, looking at those principles, are we including families? Are families an integral part of everything that we do? I wish that we had early access to a knowledgeable family professional, because they would have had a bigger scope. But you also have to make sure that families go to all of the conferences, that they know about wraparound, restorative justice, recovery, all of those things. But you need somebody with not a myopic discipline's specific lens that can look across and say, well, I don't know, have you thought about this? So having families with lived experience available to other families across every system, looking at all.
That's a very good point. It's something that really touches everything. It's one of the reasons that the theme of this show is not more tightly based, is I was like, when you super silo information, it's fantastic if you know what silo you're in. But if you don't, or if you're in the wrong silo, it's very, very hard. And so that was one of the theories behind making a Broadway show, like, 'cause if you go to a pulmonologist, they're going to look for problems in your lungs. They're not necessarily going to check to see if your joints are okay. All right. So the next question that I had for you that I was going to ask, which is sort of a like adjacent, it's a hard role to be an adult, a modern adult. And one of the pressures that some people feel that I wonder if you felt is did you, in your experience going through this, where you had a very public facing, your son was going through struggles that were in public, in school, in the community, and you were there, did you feel isolated or even judged by the other people in the community, based on something that somebody else was doing, your son was doing, how he was showing up?
So we were very frequently judged. People come up with their own theories about why things happen. Everything from we were in the wrong faith to we were, you know, if I would just join this person's church, it would all be fine. Very common is, well, you just give me that kid for 5 minutes and I'll fix it. It's like, no, he'll have you shaking under the table. And three. But they don't know that. They're coming from their experience and saying, and part of that is protective. Part of that is, if I can frame people having trouble in ways that it won't touch me, then I'm safe. And it's not going to happen to my kids or my grandkids or my people I love, because they did this bad thing, and that's who that happens to. And we have this idea that good people have good things happen to them, and if if this happens, if your family has whatever, then there must be something bad.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's the reason I brought it up, 'cause that's an impossible amount of pressure to put on people who are going through this, because it's not, in my experience, one to one. You know, that healthy parents don't guarantee that you do not have a child who has an
Absolutely.
illness, right? These are not value judgments on people. And the same thing is true. It's not a guarantee that if you follow the instructions that you're given in what to expect when you're expecting, that your teenager is not going to crash a car when they're 15, or much worse things. And it is a tough place to be. And I would say, if somebody's got two stepkids and two kids, there's a point in every adult's life where somebody in your family is going to go through something like this. And so, n maybe not to an extreme degree, but people are not perfect, you know, like they're not. Kids are going to, you know, get in trouble and make mistakes, and so
Well,
it's
and mistakes is are how we learn. I
right,
mean, all of us
mistakes and
learn
right.
that.
Yeah,
All of
and
us
yeah.
learn that way. It is normative. From that perspective, we learn by screwing up
Yeah.
and going, huh. And I guess to some extent you can call that behavioral.
But yeah, and there are, the
It can be
acceptance
taken
of,
far.
yeah, and I think it is on a regular basis. And I think that part of that is, like, I think that, so I'm glad that you were willing to talk about that, because it is, I really appreciate the lens that people do it as a way of protecting themselves. Like, I'm going to push you out and judge your actions because I want to believe that it's going to keep me and my family safe, which is something we're all doing. All right. So, in a second, you and your son wrote a book.
Yes.
And that is available, and I want to give you a chance to talk to people about the book. And if you want to, if it's helpful for people, if you want to tell people how to reach out to you in any way after they listen to this interview, you can do that too.
So the book is No Saints Here. It's a long title, A Cautionary Tale of Mental Health Illness and the Cost of Ignorance in the Lone Star State, because that is our story. Aaron has written his parts, and he frankly started his way before I did. I was a chicken. I did not want to put him out there with the eternal hope that he would find some recovery. I didn't want that to be baggage that he had to pull. Once he died, I had all the freedom in the world to throw it out there. So he had done mostly his parts of the book, and I began at that point transcribing them. He left me with three boxes of scraps of paper. It's really hard to keep up with writing when you're homeless.
Yeah.
And so he left me with these three boxes, and I had to sort and organize. His wife had started some of that, and then I took and wrote my what was going on with me, and I tried to do that extremely honestly, because I really wanted families to be able to see me, warts and all. Because sometimes people see, I kept going to school until I couldn't go anymore, and I pushed myself into every evidence-based practice room that I could. And so it's easy to look at me now and think this is who I've always been, and it's not. And so I want families to be able to see that ugly, dirty kind of, I don't know what the hell, let's try this
Yeah.
dumpster fire that I often was, and how that looked at each of the stages of his life. And then beyond that, what do we know now? Because there are evidence-based practices. There are things that we know work. They're just still decades later not available to families.
Yeah, it's really
And
interesting. One of the
so,
things it's like it's I my expertise is not like institutional or any. I'm not a doctor or a clinician or anything, but I feel sometimes like the systems are upside down. So, coming out of the sort of community trauma that happened during lockdown. For kids in school and all of those things. And, people were dealing with so many people were dealing with anxiety and all of these things. But the system was so overloaded that if you didn't already have, doctors and so on and so, it was really hard to get in the door until you had gotten to a point of crisis, right? And when you're talking about like you were desperate and so on and so forth. And it was really interesting because I was like, you don't want this to only work this way. Like, you want there to be interventions to prevent crisis, not a system that relies on support only being offered after there has been an emergency. Somebody has been arrested, somebody's committed a crime, somebody has gone completely
and
into psychosis and disrupted their whole life. But
I
that
would
is
argue
still the
that it's
way,
still the case.
right? That is still the way it works, even though, even
And it
though.
was the case before COVID. COVID may have peeled the curtain back a little for a part of the population that we don't normally think
Right. And it
has
really
that,
was like, yeah.
but I'm not sure that it caused it.
No, and I didn't mean that was a mis it
I
sort
think
of
no, but I think it was there all along. It's still
yeah.
there, and we're still failing to do the things that we know will make it better. And
Yeah.
sadly, again, I recovery is the adult corollary to wrap around, and adult systems should all operate by those principles. But the earlier you can get to it, the more efficient that it is. But there's a lot of pushback
Yeah.
around mental
And
health because people conflate mental health and mental illness, one.
oh, okay, that's a good
And
point.
so to think, when you're talking about mental health promotion in schools, you're not talking about labeling kids. So I'm an occupational therapist. And one of the reasons I can do mental health work in the schools is people don't think of me as a mental health practitioner. So I don't diagnose anybody. How do you help this person succeed? What do you want to do, and how do we do that? And unfortunately, we have so conf mushed together mental illness and mental health that when you say mental health, people hear mental illness and labels. And so they don't want their precious child to get those labels. And I absolutely get that. But we need to be promoting mental health and well-being for families, for kids, for everybody.
And I think, and one of the things that, and then we go to the final questions is I think the honesty of showing people what it looks like to be navigating a situation in desperation. It's not reasonable to expect that a new parent or a spouse or an aunt or an uncle or anybody who's a corollary to somebody who's really struggling would be an expert. Like it is, that you're not gonna know. You're not gonna know. And so that is how anybody's gonna start this situation, whether you're talking about, you're finding out the, your kid has a food allergy, you don't know anything about it to anything else. And I think that that's an important part of it. All right. So I want to thank you for sharing that story, sharing about the book. I'll put the information for where people can find the book in the show notes. And the best way to get that information is always to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email community, which there's links for that there. And you can go to the website, imperfectadulting.com. Claudette, are you ready for the final three questions?
Ready or not, here I am.
All right, very good. These are just for fun. All right, very good. So now today, are you a person who has a perfectly detailed schedule of your day that you stick to, or are you more of a spontaneous fly by the seat of your pants person?
Neither. I'm a hot mess. I'm more spontaneous fly by the seat, but I won't get everything done if I do that. So I have loose lists that I work off of and add to, but things fall off of them all the time.
Very good. All right. So, if you, and this is, I think this works because you're in Texas, which is a giant state. If you're in a car for a longish drive, what type of entertainment are you doing? Are you listening to music on the radio? Are you listening to a podcast like this one? Maybe an audiobook, calling a friend, something else?
Mostly podcasts, a little bit of music too when it gets too heavy. So
There you go.
podcasts and music.
Very good. All right. And third and final, if you were a contestant on a game show and you won an all-expense vacation, where would you want that to be? What kind of trip? Would you want it to be a beachy vacation, a cruise on a boat, a mountain getaway, glamping at a national park, or a famous cosmopolitan city with museums and culture?
So I love the mountains. That's one. But I think if I could go anywhere, I would go to Bamberg, Germany, for the Kringle
Oh, yeah, to do the Christmas
Marts.
market trip. Yes. Oh, well, I hope that that is a trip that comes up in the future then. That is something people can do as a tour. I have some
Yep, I
friends
did
who have
those
done
as a
that.
child because we lived over there, and I just have fond memories. I love Christmas, so. The Christkindl Marts is where I would go.
That is a fantastic idea. That's it, Claudette Fetti. Thank you so much for being an amazing
Thank
guest today on
you.
the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself. Head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.